This is Tortilla con Sal. Here we are again in conversation with our good friend, Gerald A. Pereira.
After our last conversation, when we were talking about the issue of racism and its relation to anti-imperialist struggle, especially with regard to Syria and Libya, I came across this phenomenon, I suppose is the right word, in France, of this supposed comedian Dieudonné and his association with a writer called Alain Soral. It seems to me that there's no doubt at all that Dieudonné and Soral are anti-Semitic. And I was very struck by the fact that Dieudonné is apparently involved in some litigation with one of the colonial families in Martinique, and he's making the point about reparations and the role of the French colonial classes in the exploitation of Martinique. And you know, and obviously you can extrapolate from that to the broader question of European colonialist powers and their duty to pay reparations to the colonial peoples that they exploited. But what I found very difficult to assimilate was the fact that this criticism was coming from somebody who's very much associated with the right wing in France. How do you view that, the Dieudonné phenomenon? And I don't know if it's possible to talk about this in relation to the litigation between this family in Martinique and Dieudonné.
I haven't been following on Dieudonné, whatever they call him, his last name, Barambala. I haven't been following him much, and I don't know much about this case, this litigation, this French family from Martinique. I do know that the family, they've built an empire. They have thousands of employees. They're financially very strong, and he was addressing the issue of reparations. What I can say is across the Caribbean at this time, there is a movement across the Caribbean addressing the issue of reparation for the descendants of kidnapped Africans and the Africans who worked on the plantations in this part of the world and who died. So you have reparations committees, and so, for example, in all of these, both in the English-speaking Caribbean, and I guess the same is to a certain extent happening in some of the French-speaking countries of the Caribbean. But there is an issue. Reparations is an agenda here. Before I get into that, I'm just telling you what is happening here is that it's at two levels. You have the governments are talking, for example, to Britain. Caribbean governments are speaking with Britain. And then you have those on the ground who are pushing it to the ground. What is happening so far is that nothing much is coming out of it. I mean, we have here in the Caribbean, Sir Hilary Beckles from Barbados. He addressed the British Parliament on the issue of reparations. But when you listen to the address that he gave, it was like they were just asking the former colonial masters to acknowledge what happened, to get some official apology, and to get reparations in one way or the other, including the monetary aspects of it. But, you know, those of us on the ground, we are saying that it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen because they're already putting pressure on a number of governments, and they've applied pressure on Jamaica. So what they're trying to do is to divide or destroy the reparations movement in the Caribbean, in the English-speaking Caribbean. Because if you get into the issue of reparations and that aspect of paying out financially, it's going to bankrupt those countries. It's going to bankrupt them. And you know the capitalist countries are in serious crisis. And just to go back on the issue of Libya and the Libyan revolution, Libya was the only country in Africa to seek reparations from the former colonizers and obtain it. Italy agreed to pay Libya over the next 20-something years millions of dollars, which total up to billions annually. So the Libyan Jamahiri was the only country that was able to get that in Africa. And it raised eyebrows because the other countries were saying, the other European countries, the West European countries were saying, well, if that is what is going to happen, if Libya could get this, then what about the Congo and other countries, Belgium in the Congo and France in Congo and other areas? So that was another reason, so many of them, for the destruction of the Jamahiri. I was there at the time when they negotiated it. It happened under the watch of Silvio Berlusconi. There was huge sums that Italy was paying billions for the next 20-something years. So, you know, that didn't go down well in the Western circles of imperialism. Getting back to this issue now with Julian, I know that he has raised this issue of reparations. And I've listened to some of the statements that he has made and his connection to Alain Searle, a writer and a sociologist who moved some time ago from Marxism towards a sort of a right-wing populist position. And this is what I want to address, because today now, in today's world, this world of globalization, which is driven by the neoliberal ideology, we found that right now the lines between left and right are being blurred in certain countries and certain places of resistance. For example, you have what is called the New Right, and many of them, they've been influenced by the writings of Alain Benoît, who you know is from the French school, the New Right. And the New Right in Europe or in France is different to what was known as the New Right in the United States, because the New Right in France are more populist in their orientation, and they are very anti-capitalist, and at the same time, they're anti-communist. But what is happening is that they're saying that with this global plantation that globalization has created, where it just wants to destroy cultures and create this autonomous individual that is uprooted from his culture, and the only thing that he's anchored in is the marketplace. So they're identifying all of these negative impacts of globalization on culture and French culture, their way of life. They don't want McDonald's. They see McDonald's and Coca-Cola and all of that as part of the cultural imperialism of American domination. And they're rejecting it. So what has happened over the years, I think over roughly over this thing has been happening for the past 20 years, there has been a sort of a convergence between, if you want to refer to it, that category as a left wing. There's a convergence between some left wing forces and personalities with people would have identified them as the right wing. For example, you have the right wing populism of Buchanan in the United States. He said America should stay out of these wars, the wars of empire and what have you, right?
Yeah, I'm very similar to that politician. I've forgotten his name now. Ron Paul.
That's right. This thing has been happening for a number of years. So I'm not surprised when I see someone like Jourdan in the same company of Alain Searle, you know, because what is holding them together is what is called an anti-Zionist perspective. There's the anti-Zionist dimension and also the anti-capitalist and what you call this philosophy of economic nationalism. Countries want to disengage, whether in Europe from the European Union or the IMF or the World Bank, and that governments must somehow protect against the onslaught of international capital. So this is the pattern. This is where they've been going for a number of years, and we arrive at it. But having said that, I want to draw the line between being anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, anti-Zionist, because there are many Jews who are anti-Zionist. We're anti-Zionist, we're not anti-Jewish. The Libyan revolution, the Al-Fatah revolution, always made it clear that we're anti-Zionist. But we also have to be careful when we speak about anti-Semitic, because sometimes when progressive forces or revolutionary forces or revolutionary force personalities or so attack Zionism or the rogue state, the state of Israel, we're accused, Arabs included, of being anti-Semitic when Arabs themselves are Semitic. So it doesn't hold.
Sorry, Gerald. I've got various comments in response to your observations. I've read quite a bit about Dieudonné and Searle. In the case of Martigny, the case is being brought against him by this extremely wealthy colonial family in Martigny because they happen to be a Jewish family, and Dieudonné has attacked them on that basis. As you said, the movement of which they're a part is difficult to define, but they define themselves as anti-system, although Dieudonné himself is an extremely wealthy individual. They define themselves as anti-system, and they have a lot of support, as you said, among people who reject the European Union. But one of the things that, for me, completely discredits them is this: they put a lot of emphasis on the Jewish conspiracy in France. Now, there may be some preponderance of Jewish families in among the French elite, but it's a completely different thing to start talking about a sinister Jewish conspiracy, you know? And it seems to me very clear, and I agree, for example, with James Petrus on this, that there's a very strong and dominant Zionist lobby in the United States that has taken captive US foreign policy in many senses. And that's probably certainly true in France as well. But if you read the material that Dieudonné is actually projecting and disseminating and distributing, there's no doubt at all that he's taking the phenomenon of what many people call the Holocaust. There are all kinds of observations you can make about that, but I don't think there's any question at all that the Nazi genocide against the Jews during the Second World War was one of the most concentrated and grotesque and extreme examples of racism that humanity has ever experienced. What I find extremely objectionable about Dieudonné is that he's actually undermining it. The absolutely clear case that many, many writers, and in my own case, I didn't come to progressive anti-imperialist positions originally as a result of reading writers like Marx and Lenin and so forth. I came to anti-imperialism because as a teenager I came across the writings of Malcolm X. And I came across the writings of Eldridge Cleaver back in the 60s. And I was very affected by the civil rights movement in the United States and the anti-Vietnam War. But also I was very affected by French writers like Simone Weil, a Catholic writer who took up anti-imperialist positions. And so my arrival at anti-imperialism has been somewhat different to that of many people on the left. The thing that has always struck me about Simone Weil and other left-wing writers is that they were very clear that, although she died before the concentration camps and labor camps were opened, she was very clear that what the Nazis were doing in Europe was simply a continuation of what the other European powers had been doing in their colonies for centuries. And so I feel deep antipathy towards Dieudonné and Sorel when they very clearly denigrate what happened to Jewish people during the Second World War. And of course to a whole other categories of people, homosexuals, Roma, you know, a whole series of other people. But the group that was mainly affected was undoubtedly the Jewish population in Europe. And so when they engage in this deliberate campaign of insulting that memory, it seems to me that there's very little difference between what they're doing and what the racists at Charlie Hebdo were doing with their caricatures of Islam. It seems to me that there's very little difference between what Dieudonné and Sorel and people who agree with them and support them are doing and the anti-Islamic racism that is being used to stoke the psychological war, the West psychological war, against Muslims around the world. And so I find that whole area deeply disturbing, and I completely reject Dieudonné and Sorel, and I think that they're actually undermining the case for reparations.
You know, somewhere you mentioned when you were speaking about Simone Weil, and you spoke about understanding the spirituality or the spiritual dimension of our struggle. You know that is important. I want to say this. You see, we live in a world where many political organizations, or the secular left, to use that term, the secular left and some of the liberal right, not because we have the conservative right, on top of the liberal right, they're grounded in what you call a secular politics. And when you have a secular politics, then you find that when it comes to standing on some principles, you don't do that, right? It becomes about expedience and what have you. For example, the enemy of my enemy becomes my friend. You take that position when you're grounded in that secular type of politics. The enemy of your enemy becomes your friend. But when your politics is spiritually infused and grounded, then the enemy of my enemy is not necessarily my friend. You see? So what many of these organizations do and their personalities and so on is if they see someone bashing another one and they happen to dislike that person or organization, then they tend that person that or organization automatically becomes their ally. And we have to be careful with this. And I think that was one of the mistakes. I, with all respect for Mao Zedong, you know, Mao Zedong said, we support whatever the enemy opposes. And we oppose whatever the enemy support. And that left a mistake. Chinese that in their foreign policy. And it left a mistake in Angola, where you had the Sino-Soviet conflict. And the Chinese saw the Russians as the principal enemy, right? So you had the Chinese military advisors in Angola on the same side with military advisors from South Africa who were supporting the FNLA and UNITA in the fight against the MPLA. You see how you can take that principle and extend it, and it is wrong. You know, this is one of the things about Islam, for example. We don't compartmentalize our world and our life. We see everything as interconnected, interrelated, and as a whole. So our politics must be spiritually infused. Our politics must be ethical. So you have these personalities like Judah and Alain Sirall, and them, instead of attacking, drawing the line carefully and focusing their attack or the condemnation on Zionism, they consciously or unconsciously equate all Jews with Zionism, and this is wrong.
There's something absolutely fundamental that anti-imperialists have to their thinking and actions on, and that is the fundamental equality of all people and the fundamental duty of respect that we owe to all people. You know, and so when that's violated, and it seems to me that you're entering territory that becomes at best ambivalent and at worst counterproductive.
This thing about the Jewish conspiracy, you know, in the Caribbean, historians have found that some of the names of the big merchants and so, some of the names that popped up who supported and helped finance the slave trade were Jewish names and Jewish personalities. There's historical evidence to prove that many of the ships that and the companies that were involved in the infamous transatlantic trade in captive Africans were financed by personalities who happened to be Jews. They were wealthy Jewish merchants in Spain, in Portugal, and in other places. And this is where people like Judah is focusing on this Jewish conspiracy, you know.
The fundamental flaw with that, apart from its inherently objectionable moral character, is that it doesn't help confront the sources of power that are exploiting and oppressing people, in particular here in Latin America and the Caribbean. And one of the poignant things about the involvement of Martinique in this business with Dieudonné is that two of the great leaders of anti-colonial, anti-imperialist thought came from Martinique, Aimé Césaire and Frantz Fanon. And so there's so many threads that are in this affair that one might call it, I suppose, of Dieudonné's, the litigation against Dieudonné from this family in Martinique, that it'll be interesting to follow it and see how it develops.
They have no real anti-imperialist perspective. It is well documented. If you look, for example, at what the Nazis did, the Jews who the Nazis exterminated, the majority were communists and socialists. You look at the leaders, Rosa Luxemburg, you have people like Karl Redeck, many leaders of the then Communist Party or the left formations in Germany when Hitler came to power, even before Hitler came to power. The Communist Party was very strong in Germany, and many of the leaders were Jews, Jewish background. There are some theories that because Hitler hated the communists, and many Jews happened to be communists, there were Zionist groups who collaborated with the Nazis. They even gave the information, they even provided information to the Nazis on militant Jewish leaders who were communists. So to trivialize or try to just dismiss the Jewish Holocaust, and there are other Holocausts, yeah, the Maffa, the African Holocaust, to try to trivialize those things or just reduce them just a footnote in history, that's not genuine, and it indulges in not only historical revisionism, but it's also an insult to the sections of humanity that is resisting fascism, imperialism, and all forms of systems that seek to subjugate humanity.
And I think that they deliberately set out to deeply insult, and I think that's one of the things that they do, and I think one of the reasons that they do it is because they're very well aware of, you mentioned this earlier, of the huge mass of disaffected people, especially young people, in countries like France, who are very vulnerable to that kind of manipulation, because I think it is a blatant manipulation. And so they, Sorel and Dieudonné have built up this really quite substantial following on the basis of projecting themselves as anti-system, as somehow brave, outspoken individuals bucking the system. But they don't actually reject the capitalism as such.
Because they don't understand how capitalism operates, how it functions. They have no understanding of it, and you're right. They don't reject capitalism as such, but they reject the effects of it.
I think the response to movements like that kind of anti-system movement has to be one based on socialism, based on the historical foundations of socialism, which are an insistence on the dignity of the human person, respect for the human person, and the right of all people to a decent life.
They're not socialists. They're not, and I don't think they understand that either. They're what you call populists. And as I said, in the populist movement today, there's a convergence of all of these trends, including what some people refer to, what you could refer to as neo-Nazis. I think it was about 6-7 years ago, there was a conference, not the first, Tehran in Iran. And that conference brought together writers and thinkers from the radical right who converged in Iran for that conference. And one of those personalities was David Duke. Because David Duke would have written about the Jews, it doesn't mean he's written about the state of Israel and how the state of Israel controls the United States. It doesn't mean we're going to invite David Duke to a conference.
It's not enough merely to be anti-US government, is it? There has to be some kind of moral and political base.
I think the way we are today, the term left and right, we have to be very careful now with it too. Because we're seeing this, you know. I don't know if this sort of categorization, right, left and right, is still relevant. I don't know how relevant it is today. We have to realize its origin coming out of France at that time, in the early days of the French Revolution. And there are certain things that, you know, to the secular left, if I speak of my belief in God, or I speak about the spiritual dimension, or that there's a transcendental dimension to all civilizations, then I am dismissed as an idealist, or I can be defined as right-wing for that.
That's absurd, isn't it?
And it is absurd. So if I stand against capitalism, I believe the wealth of the country should be used in such a way that every human person should benefit from it. I'm against capitalism, against imperialism, and that I put forward a socialist alternative. I am a socialist. Then I would be categorized as left, as left-wing. So that's why Brother Gaddafi once said, he said, if you look for me on the left, you will find me on the right. And if you look for me on the right, you will find me on the left. All he was saying was that we'd reached a point where this this sort of categorization was no longer relevant or somewhat absurd, because we have to look at it in its context and the time where the left-right divide came about.
Yeah, that's certainly a very important issue here in Latin America. I think people who supported the Venezuelan Revolution were embarrassed by the spirituality of Hugo Chavez, for example.
Absolutely. You know, Hugo Chavez said the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, that's the party in Venezuela, the Chavista, he said we're socialists, we're a socialist party, we're anti-capitalist, anti-imperial. He said, but we're not Marxist-Leninists. He said we acknowledge the truth and the contribution of Marx and Lenin and Mao Zedong and Trotsky and all of these people, all of these revolutionary theorists to this body of knowledge. But he said that the party is not Marxist-Leninist, it's socialist. Because it was shaped, as you said, I mean, it's like the Sandinista in Nicaragua. The Ortega brothers came out of the radical student movement, the gospel of the poor, the impact of Gustavo Gutierrez and Willy Bonino, and all of the liberation theology that critique capitalism and show that the teachings of Christ and the gospels was more in common with the ideals of Marx, for example.
here in Nicaragua at the moment, and one of the reasons that Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo and their colleagues have been so successful in building and maintaining popular support, I mean, they have something like over 70% support, Daniel and Rosario, as individuals, and the FSLN party in recent elections has got over 60% of the vote. So, and one of the reasons for that, apart from all the economic success, has been that they're very much in tune with the cultural sensibilities of the people of Nicaragua.
Very important, that's right. And they don't have that dogmatic position that was characteristic of a number of pro-Soviet parties in the region.
And here in Nicaragua, and if you look at people that were hardline Marxists during the 1980s, those people have left the FSLN and they tried to form Social Democrat parties, and now they're only able to muster something like 0.8% support nationally.
2 days ago, I was addressing this issue. One of the reasons for the left not being strong in the Caribbean, or the anti-imperialist forces almost non-existent or silent, is precisely this. Because when the Soviet bloc collapsed, what was referred to as actually existing socialism, these Marxist-Leninists, you had the Workers' Party in Jamaica and the Workers' Party in Barbados, and there was different groups across the Caribbean. When the Soviet bloc collapsed, they lost their bearings. They lost their bearings. And many of them who didn't move to, very few moved to social democracy. We had cases where many of them ended up referring to themselves now as liberal Democrats. But those of us who were in the tradition, those of us who knew that the Soviet, what existed in the Soviet Union, was not actually existing socialism. The Libyan Revolution, I remember we had a conference in Libya just after the collapse of the Eastern Bloc. And the conference was about the way forward after what took place. And Brother Gaddafi made an interesting point. He said if Poland and these countries in the Soviet bloc, if it was actually existing socialism, how come the workers were revolting against themselves and their interests? And he said that what existed there was a form of bureaucratic collectivism. It was not socialism. And that the fight for socialism has now really begun. And this was true because regardless of what some of the, we cannot deny the achievements they made, but the people themselves, the communist parties in those countries, substituted themselves for the mass activity, the self-activity, which Marx himself argued for, the conscious self-activity of the masses advancing their own cause, the communist party, the people were just there to be led.
I remember Don DeBar in a recent conversation, he was noting that the solidarity movement in Poland was almost a template for the so-called color revolutions that we've seen in more recent years.
That followed in other countries. That is true. And now those groups and those people that you were referring to who moved from Marxism, Leninism to social democracy. But there is this way forward, what we call, the Green Book referred to it as natural socialism or people socialism, or what Evo Morales referred to as the communitarian socialism. And all of these, regardless of the name, is a form of a rejection of the statist approach, or where, you know, the state becomes the main arena for social transformation. We're saying that it has to be from the bottom up, and it has the people involved in their own organizations moving the way forward, and not that instrumental, the state being the main player in this revolutionary and evolutionary process.
Well, here in Latin America, people would very much agree with the idea that you've just explained, but they might point to the importance of a strong national state in terms of being able to defend that structure that you're talking about. Because my personal objections to the ideas of anarchists is that it's a nice theory, but how in practice do you then defend those kinds of anarchist democratic participatory structures against an external aggressor like, for example, the imperialist United States or Nazi Germany or some similar
predator. It seems to me that what's enabling Venezuela to protect its Bolivarian process and what's enabling Nicaragua to defend its Sandinista process, and the same in Bolivia and in Ecuador, is that you have the structures of a national state in the hands of progressive movements, progressive political movements that are committed to direct participative democracy, but recognize the role of the state in defending that.
Once imperialism exists, once it is there, then revolutionary-oriented states or countries where we have progressive regimes, you will need a strong state. But when I speak of the strong state, I'm speaking about a state where the people are mobilized and the people are not apart from the state apparatus. So what I'm saying is, I'm talking about a state with the democratic state as opposed to the authoritarian state. I know the anarchists will say that the state is inherently authoritarian, but in the Jamahiriya, they spoke about the state of the masses, which was that the state being at the service of the people rather than the state imposing itself. The state started in its state embodied the will of the people. In other words, you had an armed people. It was an armed people and in Libya because of the state that was able to defend itself against NATO and the United States for almost for 10 months. This didn't exist in Egypt and it didn't exist in Tunisia. The point I'm making is in Venezuela, in Ecuador and in Bolivia, you need a state, a strong state to defend the gains of those revolutions.